Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
This broadcast of Intersection was originally recorded at the Broadway Brewery on March 16th, 2012. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Intersection, recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. I'm Reuben Stern. Today's show is a special co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. The program is also a collaboration with Iowa Public Radio, NET Nebraska, Kansas Public Radio, KCUR in Kansas City, and KBIA here in Columbia. If you're a typical consumer, you might not know all the details of how your food is produced. And no wonder. With all the competing messages surrounding food and farming today, it's often difficult to know what's fact, what's fiction, or what's just an exaggeration. This can also be a big problem for the farmers and ranchers who create America's food supply. Public perceptions increasingly are influencing the way farmers produce the food we eat. For example, last month, McDonald's, under pressure from animal rights groups, announced that it would work with pork suppliers over the next few years to end the use of crates to hold pregnant sows in small individual spaces. Pork producers say this could raise prices for consumers. So, what information influences your decisions about the food you eat? And how are the various stakeholders trying to shape those thoughts about what you consume? Our panel of experts today will talk through the messages surrounding where our food comes from. First on our panel, Mike Adams is the host of AgriTalk, a syndicated talk show about issues important to rural America. Welcome to the program, Mike Adams. Also with us today, Chris Chin is a hog farmer, fifth-generation family farmer, and former chair of the American Farm Bureau Federation's Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee. Welcome to the program, Chris Chin.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us as well. Also with us today, Bruce Friedrich is Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives at Farm Sanctuary, a farm animal protection organization. He is the co-author of the Animal Activist Handbook. Welcome to the program, Bruce Friedrich.
Thanks, Reuben. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. And finally on our panel today, Wes Jamison is an associate professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University. His research involves political communication and public relations as it relates to food, agriculture, science, politics, and corporate communications. Welcome, Wes Jamison.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have all of you with us. To start off with, we thought we'd take one specific example. During the Grammy Award show in February, the fast food chain Chipotle aired a commercial that caused a stir among many livestock producers. The two-minute animation depicts the rise of the industrial food system and a modern return to pastoral farming, which Chipotle then presented as its approach to sourcing ingredients. What happens to the pigs in the middle is not pretty. Christian, you're a farmer. What do you make of this ad?
Well, you know, I thought it was very inaccurate. It didn't show the real story of why farmers have moved their livestock indoors to protect them. It didn't show the animals in the winter times when there's 2 feet of snow on the ground trying to stay warm and protect their young. It didn't show the predators attacking these young animals and killing them. All of these are the reasons that we've moved our livestock indoors today. And so they just took parts of the story and put it together to tell a story, but it wasn't accurate. And it didn't talk about all the ways that farmers care for their animals or the way that they protect their animals on a daily basis.
Wes Jamison, you've talked a lot about the kinds of messages that people get and what farmers do or don't do in terms of shaping some of those messages. What did you think of the commercial?
I've seen the commercial. I thought it was a brilliant example of advertising. Advertising, I don't think, has ever been intended to tell an accurate depiction of circumstances on the ground. The ad was intended to create a market niche for Chipotle, and that I thought it was very, very effective at doing that. And one thing we have to guard against is that all sides in this debate tend to shave the perception and spin it in a certain way that makes them look good. And so I thought in that context, the Chipotle ad was very well done. They knew their audience, they tailored the message to their audience, and it was very effective. Was it accurate? Is advertising intended to sell ever truly accurate?
Good question. Bruce, I want to ask you about it. You know, it's interesting. This is the first time Chipotle had put an ad out on television for the national audience, and they're using an appeal for the animal welfare as the way to sell their product. What do you make of that? I mean, you're someone who has spent a lot of time trying to craft messages about animal welfare.
Yeah, I mean, it's a recognition that 97% of Americans want to see animals protected from abuse. They want legal protection for animals. You know, 97% of Americans don't agree on anything, right? I mean, even the libertarians, Republican, Democrat, libertarian, you know, as John McCain used to say, vegetarian, everybody wants to see farm animals protected from abuse. And yet, begging to differ with what Chris said, farm animals are exempt from cruelty to animals laws. And what happens to them on these factory farms and in these slaughterhouses, the American people don't support it. So it's just one example, pigs crammed into crates where they can't even turn around for their entire lives. If you did that to a dog or a cat, you could go to jail. And yet, that's what happens with pigs in this country. The level of abuse is really shocking. And when people find out about it, they're horrified. And Chipotle was, you know, playing to that concern.
All right. Mike Adams, I want to give you a chance to share some thoughts on the ad before we move on.
Well, the part I would agree with, Bruce, is, yeah, they were playing to an audience is what they were doing. And they, as Wes said, they picked an emotional tool to get that message across. I agree with Chris. I don't think it was completely accurate. It didn't. I mean, what if they'd have shown that animal wandering around outside and a wolf eating it? And that's, and the message would have been, if the animals aren't kept inside, they run this risk of being devoured by a predator. You know, so you shape the message. That's the message they wanted to get out. I didn't think it was accurate. Yeah, it was, in its own way, effective. I don't know. I missed it. I watched the Academy Awards that night. I missed it altogether. So, but, you know, that's what we're, the environment we are in now, trying to shape your message. And for their intended purposes, I'm sure it was pretty effective. But I thought it was inaccurate.
Can I ask a question? So are you, Chris and Mike, saying that the producers who allow their animals outdoors are suffering lots of death losses to wild animals who are, you know, showing up and ravaging them? Because I haven't heard that from, you know, Polyface Farms or any of the other small producers.
But Chris, I'll let you go first.
Go ahead and answer the question, and then we'll talk about what the implication of that is in terms of the message that farmers are sending about what's happening with their livestock.
Well, you know, we used to raise our hogs outdoors, so I've experienced this firsthand, and we did have a lot of predator attacks in the part of Missouri where I do live. I don't know where Polyface Farms is, so I can't attest to what they see, but I can speak from personal experience. Our newborn live pigs were getting eaten alive by coons, possums, coyotes, bobcats. We had a huge problem. They were injuring the pigs, and when they got injured, then we were forced to have to use antibiotics to take care of them. We saw that there was a better way to protect our animal, and so we moved them indoors. Bruce, I understand from listening with you that you don't agree with that, but as a farmer who has to care for those livestock, it's in my best interest to make sure that they're protected. I don't like watching a newborn pig being eaten alive by a coyote, and I found a better way to protect that animal.
But it sort of, Mike, go ahead, and then we'll keep going.
I mean, it always looks good in an idyllic scene that, you know, the animals are running loose and it's a sunny day and everything is nice and green and pretty, but it's not always that way. It can be 20 below wind chill factor, or it can be 120 in the shade, or there can be the predators. So, I mean, if you care about those animals, you're going to take the steps to put them in protection from the environment that could harm them. So I know you look at it as that is some kind of inhumane treatment. To me, it is humane treatment to take them out of the elements that would cause them harm.
Well, Wes Jamison, I want to bring Wes back into the conversation here, because I don't want to talk about whether we eat animals today. I want to talk about the messages that people are getting about what's going on with animals on farms. That's kind of why we're here today.
One of the foundations I would want to lay for the audience and those out there watching over the internet, television, or radio is that all sides here have a vested interest in spinning the message and framing it. We are not only bringing animals indoors from the outside, once they're inside, we're confining them. And there are very real historical antecedents and reasons why we confine animals. The same reason that 2,000 to 4,000 years ago, shepherds brought the sheep into the pen was to protect them from predators and so that all that energy they ate went to production. That's reasons we do it in agriculture today. We bring animals indoors so all the food they eat, all the metabolizable energy goes to growth and not to walking around or creating body heat. So there are very real production reasons and profitability reasons to have them inside in addition to protection. The difficulty becomes, how do you communicate that to an audience that doesn't understand and doesn't agree? And I would say the Chipotle ad, along with Farm Sanctuary, Humane Society, and other groups, have learned to communicate complex issues in very simple terms that make sense and are relevant to consumers, whereas agriculture is struggling to make that message the same way. Can they communicate the facts of agriculture in a simple way that makes sense to consumers?
Okay, I want to remind our audience once again, this is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today we're exploring the messages and motives behind farm and food controversies. Joining us are Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives at Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jameson, an Associate Professor of Communications at Palm Beach Atlantic University. It gets to a large question in terms of who's good at communicating, who's not good at communicating when we talk about these kinds of issues. Bruce, what's working in terms of the animal welfare groups and getting their message out?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of Americans, we are animal lovers. We want to see animals protected from abuse. And people recognize that if an animal is not able to do anything that is natural to her or to him, that is going to cause the animal both psychological suffering as well as physiological suffering. So the American people just oppose cramming animals into crates for their entire lives or cramming hens into cages for their entire lives, which is why the ballot initiative in California, it passed in every single district to ban these practices. It passed with Republicans. It passed with Democrats. It got the highest percentage in California ballot initiative history. And it's a practice, you know, that it's banning in California effective January 1st, 2015. That is how 95% of hens are treated in this country and how more than 80% of pigs, pregnant pigs, are treated in this country. But Ruben, I do think when we're talking about food controversies, the proverbial elephant in the room is we don't have to eat animals at all. At Farm Sanctuary, we provide sanctuary to 1,000 individual animals, chickens, pigs, turkeys, cattle, and we know them as individuals. And for the same reason most people would not eat a dog or a cat, there isn't a moral difference, there isn't a rational difference between eating a chicken or a dog or a cat or a pig. They're individuals, and unless you really have to cause an animal to suffer and die, you shouldn't. We don't have to eat meat to survive, so we shouldn't.
And on the other side there are a lot of range of opinion on that. I mean, the other side, we get a lot of advertising telling us bacon tastes good, beef tastes good, pork, beef, it's what for dinner, all of those things.
That's the response,
in terms
right?
of the messaging.
It's not a moral argument. We want to do it is not a moral argument for causing animals to suffer unnecessarily in ways that would be felony-level cruelty.
Let me ask Wes, who has studied a lot of these communications issues, to what extent do you think the beef or pork industries need to be making that kind of moral statement out there in the public at this stage of the game? I mean, Bruce cited a statistic that says a lot of Americans have opinions that would favor animal welfare.
Okay, first, when you show the uninitiated consumer what happens in reality in animal agriculture, they're shocked and awed for about 48 hours, after which point they return to their previous consumption habits. That's the reality. So when you do the testing, experimental testing in the focus groups, they can't believe it's that shocking, but after about 48 hours, they return to their previous consumption habits. So that's the reality of when you show it, when you show an expose video, they're shocked, they're appalled, then they go back out and order a pork chop. Number two, I would agree with Bruce that this is principally a moral issue. If you dissect the language, Farm Sanctuary disagrees that people should have the right to use animals for their own benefit. And so they're very clear about that. They're very straightforward. Animals should not be eaten. That's a moral argument, not a scientific one, not an economic one. Agriculture has long thought that all we have to do in agriculture is trot out another scientific fact or another economic argument, and people would trust agriculturalists. That didn't work. That would not have worked with the slave-owning debate during the Civil War, and it doesn't work now. You must answer moral arguments with contradictory or contramanding moral arguments. In other words, you're going to have to eventually answer their moral argument. Otherwise, you're going to have difficulty continuing to operate.
Right. Mike, I want to ask you about some of this as well in terms of the messages that people get. You're in the media. You help inform people. I mean, how do you think this is playing out in terms of the information people are getting and whether they're getting the right information to make those kinds of moral decisions?
Well, I think it is, you know, a matter of choice. I think if organizations like Bruce had their way, that choice would be eliminated from people, that you wouldn't let them decide whether or not they want to eat meat or not. You would just take that away from them. I don't understand it. I talk to livestock people. They want people to eat meat, but they respect a person's choice to decide whether they will or whether they won't. It seems like you want to take away that choice from consumers of whether or not they'll ever get to have meat if they're not allowed to have it.
Well, no, we're an educational organization, and we say to people, we don't feel like we have to win the ethical discussion, right? Everybody agrees that animals should be protected from abuse. So our argument is just to challenge people to think, when you sit down to eat, do you want to support something that entails cruelty to animals, or do you want to do something that's kind to animals? Do you want to add to the level of misery and suffering in the world, or do you want to add to the level of mercy and kindness in the world? And that's what it really distills to. And when Wes says, you know, people see this and they're shocked by it, it's true, because it's shocking. And an awful lot of people, once they see how shockingly these animals are abused on these modern farms and in these modern slaughterhouses, they don't want to support it. So the challenge is really, if you would not personally castrate an animal without pain relief, if you wouldn't want to spend an afternoon slicing chickens' throats open, if you don't want to think about it, if you don't want to see it, don't pay people to do it on your behalf. And we're, you know, we don't have the power to take away people's right to choose. Our challenge to people is just align your ethics, which is, I don't like this, with your actions, so don't pay people to do it on your behalf.
Well, let me come back for a second. I want to bring back the Chipotle ad for a second here. Animal welfare has become a big enough issue that Chipotle is laying its business strategy on it. Chris, I'm wondering, how are you feeling the effects of that trend nationwide? Are you feeling this sense that you have to do things differently because the public is demanding that?
Well, you know, it's something that we're looking at. We care about what our consumers think. But I also want our consumers to have all the information they need to make an informed decision. You know, on Christmas morning, our kids don't get to open presents till we've gone outside and cared for our livestock to make sure they're okay. My husband gets up multiple times in the middle of the night to go check on our animals, especially like our cows when they're calving. These are the stories that aren't being told. And so when people say that we don't care for our animals, that's inaccurate. And so I think that for people to be able to make an informed decision about the food they eat, they need to have all sides of the issue presented to them. For years, farmers have been so busy caring for their land and caring for their animals, we've forgotten about consumers. So we need to be reaching out and letting people know why we've made the changes that we've made on our farms. As you see, a lot of people are framing the issue, as Wes said, to their advantage. We want to make sure that you guys know that we care about our animals. I feed my kids the same food that I raise for consumers. I love those two kids more than anything in the world, and I would never do anything to harm them. And I wouldn't feed them something that's not safe and healthy. That's a story that I think needs to be told.
Mike, your thoughts?
You know, one person could look at a crate and say that's cruel. Another person, if you showed them that sow rolling over on her baby pigs and suffocating them and crushing them because that crate wasn't there, they'd say that was cruel. So, you know, what you're trying to determine for people, what is or what isn't cruel. I don't think you can make that judgment for them. I think a lot of people are making the judgment when they eat meat. They want to eat meat. You're talking about this high percentage of people that are concerned about the treatment of animals. Oh, I understand that. What about the high percentage of people that eat meat and want to eat meat and don't want to quit eating meat?
Okay, well, first, the science on crates is overwhelming, as I'm sure you know. And the science on crates is a well-managed crate-free system is significantly better for animal welfare, which is why you can't find an animal protection group on the face of the planet that thinks crates are good for animals. Even people like Temple Grandin, who designs slaughter systems, thinks that crates have to go because they're horrible for animals. And Temple Grandin, again, who designs slaughterhouses and is a consultant with the American meat industry, she's the one who says in Animals in Translation, her book, which I highly recommend, that farm animals have the exact same core emotional needs that human beings do. You cram them into crates, you cram them into battery cages, psychologically they go insane, physiologically they deteriorate. And the farm industry, you look at legislation in Missouri right now, that because people oppose these confinement systems, there's legislation that the Farm Bureau and the Pork Producers Council are supporting that would make it so that the people can't vote on these confinement systems, because every time that people get to vote, the people vote them down. Or you look in Iowa, they just rushed through legislation that criminalizes undercover investigations, because when people see what's happening on these factory farms and in these slaughterhouses, they're opposed to it. So do the farmers make the conditions better? No. They criminalize you finding out about them.
The legislation in Iowa basically requires you to tell the truth on a job application. It's a shame we have to have a law requiring that.
Wes, I want to let you weigh in here. Help us out.
Clearly, in modern agriculture, there's a trade-off between welfare and profitability. If the farmers cannot make a profit, they can't stay in business. It's that simple. And whatever systems they believe will allow them to stay in business and remain profitable are the ones they'll adopt. So with the history of the development of modern agriculture, there's been this trade-off. And we have to remind ourselves, without groups like Farm Sanctuary, Humane Society, and the Federal Animal Welfare Act, we wouldn't be having this discussion. Secondarily, what we have to remember is that American consumers are hypocrites. They live with one animal in their house as a companion and another animal on their plate as cuisine. You can't have it both ways. And so since the 1950s, we have developed what I call a double standard of animal treatment in this country. The pet track has gone to the point where now we'll spend between $4,000 and $100,000 on the life of our pet over its 12, if it's a normal lifespan of 12 years, we'll spend between $4,000 and $100,000 on the life of a dog over the course of 12 years. We'll spend enormous amounts of money on our companion animals. We'll also want a cheap, affordable meat supply as long as we don't have to look at it. And so the communication strategy of Farm Sanctuary, of Humane Society, of PETA, has to been try to remind consumers of that hypocrisy between the fact that they treat one animal one way and another animal another way. It is significantly important for this debate that since the animal welfare movement came to prominence in 1985, meat consumption per person has gone up. What we find is in 1985, 6 billion chickens a year were produced in the United States, 6 billion with a B, now it's 8 billion. When consumers face their hypocrisy, they are shocked, and then like all hypocrites, they do a wonderful job of managing the cognitive dissonance because meat has intrinsic benefits. Those are the facts. And so Bruce's organization has to try to keep reminding them, look, you treat one animal one way, another animal another way, that's a problem. Meanwhile, agriculture is yet to stumble upon a message that more or less gives permission to those consumer hypocrites to feel good about their choice.
You don't think that the industry or the food companies have come up with messages that make people okay with that hypocrisy?
Here's what I think. I think they have tried the science and the economics, but remember, in the face of those arguments in California, uniformly the science or the scientists said that you did not need to ban cage layers and you did not need to ban the sow stalls. And economically, they said it would be deleterious for the state. It would be damaging. In spite of that, it was a landslide election saying we need to ban those, so it's been moralized. Traditionally, animal agriculture has tried to make economic and scientific arguments. Increasingly, we see when we do actual research on consumers, they don't listen to those arguments. They listen to different types of arguments.
Although, it is worth noting that the California Veterinary Medical Association came out in support of Proposition 2 and against cages. And it depends on how you define the science. If the science is production science, Will enough animals die in these cages to make them unprofitable, so you align science with economics, then the science on cages supports them. If the science is the science of people like Dr. Temple Grandin and Dr. Bernard Rollin and other people who are consultants with the meat industry, if the science is animal welfare science, psychological science, emotional science, animal physiology, well-being science, then the science is uniform against these systems. If the science were in favor of these systems, you would find some animal protection agency somewhere on the planet saying these systems are good. Look at the science. Yeah. The scientists at the animal welfare groups, from the ASPCA to the Humane Society to the RSPCA to the World Society for the Protection of Animals, they're uniform against these systems because the systems are horrible for animal welfare.
Let me remind our audience just real fast, this is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Again, we're exploring messages and motives behind farm and food controversies. Our panelists today, Mike Adams, Chris Chin, Bruce Friedrich, and Wes Jamieson. Mike, I want to give you a chance, and then we'll come back to Wes.
Yeah, we're kind of on a couple different levels here at the same time. You mentioned Dr. Grandin. I don't think she may make recommendations on production systems or practices, but she's not advocating the end of livestock production or animal agriculture. I mean, there's a big difference here. I think animal agriculture, Chris Chen will do what she needs to do to best take care of her animals. But if your end goal, as you've stated, is to have people quit eating eating meat, well, that's a whole different goal. Is your goal to protect animals by better production practices, or is it just to eliminate animal agriculture altogether? That's two different things. I don't see an outcry in this country to end animal agriculture and end meat as a food source.
Right. I want to give it to Wes for a second here.
What Bruce just participated, it's important that all of our audience understands every side is spinning this issue. There is no one side that is absolutely accurate. Bernie Rollins is not a scientist. His PhD is in philosophy. So when he speaks to animal well-being, it is not from the epistemological perspective of empirical science. It's from the philosophical perspective of a moral good. Temple Grandin knows absolutely nothing about chickens. He's a ruminant nutritionist who can only speak authoritatively on cows. Okay. So that being said, the chicken scientists, Joy Mench and others, came out against the proposal. So again, be very, very careful as we parse this debate. All sides selectively glean the information they need to make their point. And that's one of the things about the messaging. The animal rights groups and animal protection groups have been, I would argue, for the last 7 years especially, extraordinarily successful in framing information in such a way that consumers listen.
That's and what are they doing? What are they doing?
I have two salvos in my direction here. So the first thing to say is the California Veterinary Medical Association, as you know, came out against it, as did all of the animal behaviorists and animal welfare scientists at the ASPCA, at WISPA, at the RSPCA, at HSUS, uniformly in favor of banning these production systems. With regard to Farm Sanctuary's motivation, our motivation is we apply the golden rule across the species barrier. That comes to two things. One, it says, you know, as Wes says, don't be hypocrites. That is one of our key arguments. If you have a dog or a cat and you wouldn't eat your dog or your cat, spend some time thinking about what the difference is between eating a dog or a chicken, a cat or a pig. Because morally speaking, rationally speaking, there is no difference. But we're also realists. We recognize that 10 billion animals are going to be eaten this year. 10 billion animals are going to be eaten next year. And we fight for improvements in those animals' welfare. And all of the animal welfare scientists, all of the scientists who are associated with animal protection organizations anywhere in the world, they say your intuition is right. Cramming a pig into a tiny crate where she can't turn around for her entire life is immoral. Cramming hens into tiny cages where they can't even spread their wings for their entire lives is immoral. And when the Pew Charitable Trust convened a panel that included a former governor of Texas, of Kansas, as well as a former chair of the as a secretary of the USDA, as well as farmers and ranchers, they also came to unanimous support for a statement opposing gestation crates, veal crates, and battery cages. They don't pass the smell test. They're hideously abusive of these animals.
Okay, I'm
and the fact that anybody would defend them really puts them on the wrong side of the American people.
I've got to jump in here and remind everyone this is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today we're exploring the messages and motives behind farm and food controversies, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We hope you stick around.
This episode of Intersection was recorded at the Broadway Brewery on March 16, 2012.
And welcome back. This is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today we're exploring the messages and motives behind food controversies. Joining us are Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives at Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jamison, an Associate Professor of Communication at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Wes Jamison was brought in today by the Food Dialogue Center, an initiative that works with the public and hopes to continue to educate the public about production agriculture. Before we continue our discussion, I'd like to bring in Peggy Lowe. She is the Public Insight Analyst from Harvest Public Media. As part of their outreach, Peggy heard from a variety of people interested in food production. Peggy, what are they saying?
Hey, thanks. So I queried our Harvest Network about reconciling these many messages that we receive about food. The Harvest Network is our online grassroots community. We have 1,200 people, and they're offering their own expertise and experience to help us report on food, fuel, and field. So Tim Zweber, a Minnesota dairy farmer, commented about what he called farm washing. This is a guy who didn't like the McDonald's ad when they recently used farmers and it said, know your farmer. And Tim wrote, this worries me because farmers currently enjoy a relatively high status of respect from society for the job they do. I really don't like companies or politicians hijacking that respect and using it for their own benefit. Then we had Crystal Yoakum. She's a mother of three from Olathe, Kansas. She said, it seems to me we either don't talk about food or we see alarmist articles, internet, Facebook posts that point out the dangers in our food. I think people need a source that is always reliable, that we can refer ourselves and others to for intelligent discussion of food. She'd like to see a balanced source. Then we had Sylvia Burgos Toftness. She's a beef producer from Minnesota. She said she'd like to see the Farm Bill renamed the Food and Farm Bill. So that's our outreach.
Okay, thanks. I want to just, we're going to move back into the conversation. I think we've pretty much covered pig confinement, so I think we can steer clear of that in the second half here. And again, I want to get us back to the way we talk about these food issues and not necessarily the farming itself. One of the things that's really interesting in the way we talk about farm issues is a game of semantics. For example, biotech versus GMO. Same thing, two different words to describe it depending on who's doing the talking, right? So how is that affecting how informed American consumers are as we try to work through these issues as a society? Wes, I want to throw that one to you first.
Most consumers don't use complex reasoning when it comes to most decisions. Words matter. Is it global climate change or global warming? Is it marriage equality or gay marriage? Words matter. People make decisions based upon shortcuts, and those words provide the shortcuts through which they interpret the debate and the issue. And I would say that the opponents of industrial animal agriculture have been very good at creating words through which consumers begin to view things. For instance, factory farm. In two words, you conjure up all kinds of images that may or may not be accurate, but that in the future provides a filter for consumers to understand the debate. And so it's very, very good communication strategy, actually.
What would you call a factory farm if you weren't going to use the word factory farm?
What I would, gosh, that's a very good question. I would say one of two things. I would say either industrial agriculture has to own the terms factory farm and be proud of it, don't apologize for it, or they have to change the debate into something towards stewardship. Right. There is a very real antecedent for why food production has industrialized. And the reason is Americans want a cheap, affordable food supply. So whether it's in crops or animals, the data indicate that Americans want cheap, safe, readily available food, but they don't want animal abuse. So the problem is Americans want their cake and eat it too. That's why we actually confine animals. That's why we do what we do. That's why we use confinement and intensive systems that look like a factory on animals, is because it produces them cheaply, efficiently, and economically.
Chris, is your farm a factory?
You know, my farm is where I raise my kids. We've got three generations living on my farm. It's been in our family for decades, and it's something we're very proud of. I wouldn't term my farm as a factory or anything. My farm is just that. It's a farm. It's where we work. It's where we live. I think that it's very important for people to understand that farms can be of any size, and they can be of any type, and that there's not a one-size-fit-all description for any family farm. What works for me on my family farm may not work for my neighbor down the road. And it doesn't mean that I'm right, and it doesn't mean that he's wrong. It means that diversity in agriculture is good, and that if our family's able to produce safe food, that that's the end goal.
So is family farm the difference on your farm from factory farm? Is that what's different there, or is...
Well, I work with my family every day. I work with my husband, my in-laws, my brother-in-law, and my children. So family is very important to me. So I just talk about my farm as a family farm because in my mind, when I'm on my farm, I'm with my family.
Mike.
I find it interesting that, and it's because many in agriculture didn't like the term a factory that had a negative connotation. What's in a name? Well, that's a negative connotation, except we want products all the time in our society from factories that are produced in factories, and we don't have any problem with it. In fact, we're very concerned when a factory shuts down or when a factory lays off people. That we get all upset about that, but somehow we don't want a farm called a factory. So maybe we should have been calling it all along a food and energy production plant. Does that sound better? I mean, that's what a farm is, really. It produces food and it produces energy. I don't get all hung up about the factory term, except that a lot of people look at it negatively. A factory, to me, produces the goods that consumers want, and that's what a farm does.
Right. In a way, that almost sounds more scary, doesn't it? A food and energy production facility. I'd hate to have one of those by my house, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, most people don't think of a food and energy production system as someplace that animals are housed, but that's also an accurate way of describing how more than 95% of animals are raised. And it's cheap, but it's not what the American people want. And that's where we get back to, I mean, these are factories. And the idea of calling them a factory farm is that the animals are treated like inanimate objects. Nobody in this room would cram your dog or your cat in a tiny little crate for her entire life, force her to go to the bathroom there, give birth there,
right,
nurse her children,
Mike,
there.
I'm back on
the pigs, but that's that's because it illustrates the factory. We can talk about hens. You wouldn't
right.
cram five.
We can talk about any of
a,
them, but again, the word is what we're talking about here,
and
Mike.
They are
factories. And we've discovered that, and we're going to keep going on that idea, Mike. You do agricultural reporting. How do you choose which words you're going to use when you try to inform people?
Yeah, I try to pick more accurate words because there is so much in a name. We're seeing an issue right now, something called, some have labeled pink slime. Well, unless you're maybe a kid who thinks that's pretty neat to eat something that sounds like pink slime, an adult, a parent, probably is going to have a problem with the imagery. That's it. Whether it's good or bad, you could debate, but immediately people shut down. So there's a lot in a name. Biotech, I think if it had started being called biotech to begin with, it would have had a better perception. Genetically enhanced or genetically modified scared people right off the bat. That's how we got all this talk about Frankenfood. You know, all I hear is a lot of talk, well, that may be harmful or someday they may find out. But what they don't talk about is right now, this technology has been tested and tested and tested. And so far, we've found nothing wrong or no safety hazards. And in the meantime, we're producing more food on fewer acres. Society does want more food. We have a growing population, but it also is asking us to do it with fewer acres all the time because we're building on more acres, taking more land out of production all the time. So, again, it's kind of hard. How do you have it both ways? But a lot of it is perception. We have biotech food, ingredients in our food right now, and some people seem to be, you hear about those that protest, but again, the vast majority, I don't hear those protests from.
And who creates the language? Wes, I'll throw it to you for that one. Who wins in terms of deciding which word is going to be the prevailing word?
Well, all sides do research, spin research, marketing research, advertising research to come up with this. And the side that finds a simple term that can be communicated simply where people understand it, that's relevant to their everyday experience emotionally, and then repeated enough, they tend to be the ones that win. And so when you analyze the messages of animal protection groups, they tend to fit that model. They're simple, they're relevant, and they're repeated over and over and over again. When you look at agricultural messages, they tend to be complex. They have no relevance at all to their target audience's everyday experience, and so they don't stick.
Or they often go up the ladder of abstraction into concepts like freedom, right? I mean, a lot of the big ag ads tend to have fields of wheat with the American flag flying behind, right? That kind of imagery that isn't about specific words. It tends to be much more abstract concepts.
Well, it may be abstract, but it doesn't address the real issue, which is the confinement of animals. And at some point, you actually have to address that issue, and you have to address it in a term that's simple so people can understand, that's relevant, makes sense to their everyday experience, and then repeat it. I can tell you the other side has been the other side. Bruce's organization, Humane Society, have been very gifted at finding those terms to be able to frame a debate in such a way so when people think of that production practice, that's what they hear.
Mike, go ahead.
You talked about the hypocrisy of us as consumers. Well, what really was the impetus to the biotech revolution for plants in production agriculture? Consumers were concerned about the inputs that were being put out on fields. Too many insecticides, too many herbicides. They were concerned about all that. So what did the industry do? Came up with a way to breed that in to the plant.
Okay, we're getting a response from our audience that doesn't signal they agree with you.
We're not idiots.
Me?
Yeah, keep talking about us like we're idiots. We're not.
What do you mean?
Consumers. We're well-read.
Well, okay. In terms of that question of consumers being well-read, what's the right way for a consumer to parse the various messages that they're getting? Let's put it that way. So we do have a lot of well-read consumers in our audience here in Broadway Brewery. I'm sure there are a lot of them listening on our NPR and public television affiliates. How does somebody parse these messages? How does somebody get to realize which languages are being used as emotional triggers and which of them are describing what's going on? How do we parse that in an effective way? If we know that everybody's throwing messages at us that are, you know, slanted to try to get a point of view across. And we'll start with you, Wes, and then we'll hear from Mike as well.
The literature indicates, I know every academic, that's the last refuge of academic scoundrels is the literature. But the literature indicates that most consumers lack the cognitive capability and training to adjudicate this issue. In other words, to rationally think it through. And so what the literature also indicates is when you have competing claims of science, because both sides have their science, don't they? Both sides claim it, that consumers detach from listening to the science and turn to their trusted communities where they have credibility. That's what we find. And that's not necessarily an emotional detachment, but when you have, for instance, I felt like Claude Rains in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find out that scientists with animal protection groups are opposed to confinement. I'm shocked. Likewise, I'm shocked to find out that scientists paid for by the industry are for it.
Can I just chime in for a second, though?
Yeah, please, and then we'll keep going.
I mean, I think the reason that farm sanctuaries and the Humane Society of the United States and the ASPCA, I think the reason that our messages resonate is that our concern is compassion for animals. Our concern isn't our profit margins. And the reason that we got into these organizations is that we care about how animals are treated. So, yes, on the one hand, shocked that an ASPCA scientist would say these confinement systems are hideous, but they're saying it because the confinement systems are hideous. Whereas, you know, the people who are talking about global warming and they're saying global warming is a problem are by and large disinterested scientists. And the people who are saying, no, it's not a problem at all, are the people who work for, you know, the oil and the drilling companies. Similarly, the scientists who think that cramming a pig or a chicken into a tiny cage for her entire life is just fine for the animal, you know, they're bought off. And that's why they're saying that. And that's why you can't find anybody affiliated with animal protection organizations who would agree. I would say the reason our messaging resonates is that our messaging is right.
Mike, I want to go back to you on that question that we were talking about before in terms of how a consumer is supposed to parse all of these mixed messages that they're getting.
Well, I think they're struggling with that. I think a certain percentage of the audience is very much in one corner, another percentage is very much in the other corner, and it's going to be hard to change their minds either way. The group in the middle, I think, are really asking questions. They want to know. And I think as a pork producer, and Christian, I know, has opened her farm up and tried to talk to people about it, it's up to people in agriculture to explain what they're doing, why they're doing it. And then the customer, the consumer, will ultimately make that choice. I just hope they will make it based on getting the information from all sides, not just one side.
Well, Chris, Mike sort of threw it to you here. If there were one thing that you wish people knew about what goes on your farm and farms, I mean, you're representing a small portion of the agricultural output of this country, right? Most of it is coming from farms a little bit bigger than yours,
right,
to be fair. But in terms of the small farmer that you represent, I mean, what is it that people aren't understanding here that they should be, in your view?
Well, you know, my family, we own our own livestock, and that's contrary to what a lot of people say. They say that, you know, nobody raises hogs anymore on their own, and we do. I'm a consumer, too, and I'm a mom. And so the scare tactics that are being used today, I don't know everything about agriculture either. I know a lot about pigs and cattle. When it comes to other sectors, I'm not an expert. So, you know, I want to study and I want to find out the accurate information as well, too. If there's one thing that I wish I could tell everybody is that I care about my animals. Their care is our top priority. We're the ones getting up in the middle of the night to care for them. We're the ones who are responsible for them. My husband doesn't eat breakfast of a morning till our animals have been fed first. He goes out and cares for those animals. We're not selfish people. We want to provide food for our family as well for other families as well. My farm may not fit everybody's typical idea of a farm, and that's fine. But I want people to know that I'm not abusing my animals. I care for them. I protect them. I want to make sure that that family farm is there for the next generation to pass it on to my children. I want to make sure that my kids are eating a healthy food product.
And, you know, forgive me for the question if it seems like I don't understand, but how much of that is about protecting the animals because they are an economic asset on your farm as opposed to an actual, what Bruce is talking about, the concern for the animal itself as a sentient being?
Well, we care for those animals. I mean, that's why we moved them indoors, because we were watching the young pigs getting attacked, and we were watching birds track in diseases, and they were getting ill, and we were having to try and find ways to protect them. Hogs can't sweat, and in Missouri summers, it's very hard to keep them cool. We put them inside these barns, and they've got air conditioning. In the wintertime, you know, it's hard for a small pig that weighs 20 pounds to stay warm in 20 degree, 30 degree weather. So that's why we moved them indoors, so that we can help them have a safe environment to live in.
And how representative is what you're describing on your farm, do you think, of all the meat that people are eating out there?
I think all farmers care about the meat that they're producing, whether they're raising their animals outdoors or indoors. There's not a wrong or a right way to do it. As long as you're caring for that animal and making sure that they're protected, I think that's what's right.
Okay, I want to remind our audience real fast that, again, this is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today, we're exploring the messages and motives behind farm controversies. Joining us today are Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives for Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jamison, an Associate Professor of Communication at Park Beach Atlantic University. Mike, I want to ask you a similar question. In terms of the farmers that you are in communication with, how prevalent is that concern for treating the animals well as a concern for treating the animals well versus protecting an economic asset among these farms?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. And, I mean, you can't ignore, they're in it. It's their job. It's their way of life. I mean, Chris goes about it the right way, but it's also how she supports her family. So that's you can't separate, I don't think, one from the other. And there's no denying there are bad actors out there. There are some that aren't as conscious as they should be of the care of the animals, and those people must be dealt with and can't be condoned that action. But on the other hand, it is her way of life. It is her livelihood, and I am thankful as a consumer that somebody, in fact, she represents less than 2% of the population, feeds the rest of us, not only in this country, but the rest of the world. She and others like her do something that most of us either cannot or don't want to do, and that is produce the food that feeds a growing world population. I am thankful for them, for what they do. I want them to do it the best way possible. My difference with Bruce, I mean, we can disagree on production practices. Changes are evolving all the time. Changes will continue to be made in production practices. To me, it's the end game. What's the end game? Is the end game to protect animals and produce the food and fiber and energy that we need, or is the end game to eliminate animal agriculture and eliminate a food source? Right. That's my difference.
And we've talked about that divide.
We've heard from Mike and Chris about farm animal welfare and you know.
And we've heard from you about farm animal welfare too, Bruce. I mean, to be fair, we've sort of covered the animal welfare thing pretty well. I want to keep on this question of the information that people get. There's another aspect of that information that I'll let you weigh in on first: the idea of labeling foods with attributes of how the food was produced and how effective that is. And Bruce, I'll give you the opening salvo on that question of, would labeling be an effective thing for helping people understand what's going on with their food?
Yeah, and I think that's one area where it seems that we all agree, and that is that people should have eyes wide open as they make these decisions And they shouldn't take Chris and Mike's word for it, and they shouldn't take my word for it. They should investigate what's actually going on and say, does that resonate for me with what I want to be supporting? And I think for the vast majority of people, when they find out what's happening in these confinement systems, they're going to be opposed to it. One thing that Farm Sanctuary, the Humane Society, and other humane groups are supporting right now is legislation that has about 45 co-sponsors in the House. It's 3798. It will eventually phase out battery cages for hens, and it will, within a year, require that cartons have labels on them that talk about what the production practice was. It's supported by the United Egg Producers, to their credit. It's opposed by the Farm Bureau, the National Pork Producers Council, the National Turkey Federation, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. They're all opposed to it because they think when people see and are confronted with these confinement systems and the slaughterhouse, they're not going to support it. And we think that they may be right.
Mike, your thoughts on this labeling question.
Yeah, I'm not against labeling. The issue you get into, is it a label of information or is it perceived as some kind of a warning? Is it a positive to help you know more information, or is it a negative to try to scare you away from something? So it's always going to get down to how it's put together. I'm not a big label reader myself, but I know some people are, and I'm not against them having all the information. Again, it just gets back to the debate we're having here. Make sure it is accurate, balanced information, and it shouldn't be pushing one way or another. It ought to be there to help the consumer make their decision.
And how do you put balanced information on products when everyone has an axe? Not an axe grind, but an iron in the fire, let's say. Wes, I'll throw that at you.
Not through the USDA.
Really? Why do you say that? They're a government agency? They're supposed to be working on our behalf?
Our behalf. All government agencies have primary interest groups that they serve and support. So the Interior Department is primarily captured by environmentalists. I mean, this is standard operating procedure in ag politics. USDA has traditionally been very, very receptive to agricultural interest groups. Hence, for those of you who followed the food pyramid debate, and any numerous policy issues coming out of the USDA, it tends to have a disproportional influence by commodity groups. And it's just for a reason of structural issues in our democracy. Any label, here's what I think what the evidence shows, a label has to be concise and simple. So for instance, one star to five stars. Five stars or five-star rating would mean organic, natural, field-raised, no inhumane treatment. One would be confinement. What we found is with labels, the label has to be simple and concise, or the average consumer, it doesn't have any relevance. They're price consumers usually, particularly in poultry. They're price consumers, and even if you label that, consumers aren't overly interested in reading a complex label that has a lot of information. Their food choices aren't being driven primarily by rational central route information. They're being driven by price and a series of sort of shortcuts. So labeling can work. It has to be simple. It has to be concise. So I can look very quickly. Is this humanely raised? If so, on what scale? And then what happens? It becomes politicized because we live in a political culture where interest groups take a dire interest in the outcome. And once you kick it into the USDA, it's going to be a free-for-all by all the groups interested.
Well, that leads to my next question. How likely is that kind of a star system that you just described ever to happen? Is it likely that we might ever see the day where we would have that kind of information as consumers?
Whole Foods has it for their meat, don't they?
I don't know, Bruce.
I think Whole Foods has a five-star system, although the first star is already better than 99% of meat in this country. The first system is you can't have intensive agriculture for the first. I think the first star is like what Humane Farm Animal Care does right now. And then it goes up to five stars, and there aren't very many farms at the five-star level. Then there are programs like the Animal Welfare Institute has a program that involves labels. And then there are some sort of putting a stamp of approval on the worst abuses, like the Swine Welfare Assurance Program or the United Egg Producers Certified.
Right. Isn't a problem with that, like Whole Foods? There's no Whole Foods unless you have an affluent neighborhood, right? I mean, they don't put stores in.
No, it's true. It definitely does price people out, which brings back to, the information. You know, try to visit one of these, farms. Try to visit one of these slaughterhouses, and if you can't get in, ask yourself if you want to support some place that you can't even go look at, because anything having to do with beans, grains, fruits, vegetables, very easy to go see how your food is made.
Well, that does bring up what happened in Iowa legislatively. It's already been mentioned in terms of a law that would make it a crime to misstate on a job application for a farm job whether someone is working for a media enterprise. If they say they're not and then they later film and release that becomes a crime. Chris, I want to ask you about that. How much of a problem would it be if somebody were filming what goes on your farm and putting it on the internet? Why wouldn't they be allowed to do that? Why would you think that's a problem?
Well, we already did film what goes on our farm, and I put it out on the internet. It's a YouTube video so people could see what my family does. We live and we work there, and I'm not ashamed to show people. The reason that we don't allow everybody to walk in off the street into our pig barn is because we don't want to attract diseases into our pigs and make them sick. If any of my family is sick, we have a cold or something, we don't go to work that day. It's not because we want to be a wimp. It's because we don't want to make our pigs sick. We're very conscious of taking care of those animals. We have no problem letting people see what we do on a daily basis because we're proud of where we live and we're proud of where we work and we're proud of the care that we give to our animals.
Mike.
My concern more on the videos, if they find some abuse, it should be addressed right then. My problem is when an undercover video is shot and abuse is found, and it's that video is not released or authorities aren't contacted for 6 weeks after that. To me, whoever found the abuse and sat on it for that long, for whatever agenda or reasons they did, they're an accomplice. Because if any of us saw an animal being abused at that moment, I would hope we would report it immediately, not wait 6 weeks to do it.
I would challenge people to watch some of these videos and watch the people on camera complaining to their supervisors and their supervisors saying, yeah, that's what happens. Yesterday, PETA released a video. It's on the homepage, PETA.org, and you can watch the guy saying they're really wailing on these cows. And the farm manager says, yeah, that's just what happens. Similarly, when there was an undercover investigator at one of KFC's suppliers of the year, and they were ripping animals limb from limb and jumping up and down on them, he filed report after report after report trying to get something done, and the slaughterhouse operator just refused to do it. I will say that a lot of the 1% farmers, a lot of the very smallest farmers like Nicolette and Bill Nyman, who run Nyman Ranch, they're opposed to these ag gag bills. And if people are not afraid to have what they're doing seen on video, as you said, they should put in cams and say, open it up. This is what happens day to day.
We've just got a little bit of time left. Wes, I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in on this question of the cameras and whether that it represents a problem.
There's two issues. One is transparency. The other one is litigation and legislation. Every industry in the world should welcome transparency, period. Nuclear industry, crop industry. They should welcome transparency. If you can't open your doors and justify what you do, you've got a problem. I don't care what industry you're in. Okay, secondly, the idea about the videos and the ag gag bills. I have profound difficulty with ag gag bills because it kind of violates the First Amendment, right? The intent, sure, it's framed as an employment law so that it's not challenged in the Supreme Court, but the intent is to stop the release of decontextualized videos. That's what it is. That's the intent. So what I would say is, one, it may be unconstitutional. Two, it's not going to stop anybody from shooting the videos. For heaven's sakes, the Florida Turnpike, the speed limit 70, no one goes 70. Everyone's going 85. Since when does a law stop behavior or alter behavior? So we're still going to have mercy for animals shooting videos, and all you're going to do is create martyrs out of the people who are whistleblowers.
Okay, unfortunately, I've got to stop us right there. That's all the time that we have for the broadcast. I'd like to thank our guest, Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer from Missouri, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives for Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jamison, an Associate Professor of Communication at Palm Beach Atlantic University. This edition of Intersection was recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It was a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today's producers from KBIA, Raymond Tungekar, Leanne Butkovic, and Melanie Gibson, and from Harvest Public Media, Peggy Lowe, Jeremy Bernfeld, and Jessica Najunas. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra and Ryan Williams. Ryan Femuliner is our audio engineer with audio assistance from Pat Akers. Donna Vestal and Janet Saidi are executive producers. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us.
The episode of Intersection that you just heard was originally recorded at the Broadway Brewery on March 16th, 2012.